Penguin Random House Audio presents Pineapple Street by Jenny Jackson. Read for you by Marin Ireland. For Tori. Millennials will be the recipients of the largest generational shift of assets in American history, the great wealth transfer, as finance types call it. Tens of trillions of dollars are expected to pass between generations in just the next decade. Zoe Beery, The New York Times. I live in Brooklyn. By choice. Truman Capote. Prelude. Curtis McCoy was early for his 10 o'clock meeting, so he carried his coffee to a table by the window, where he could feel the watery April sun. It was a Saturday, Joe Coffee was crowded, and Brooklyn Heights was alive. Women in running tights pushing strollers along Hicks Street, dog walkers congregating at the benches on Pineapple Street, families dashing to soccer games, swimming lessons, birthday parties down at Jane's Carousel. At the next table, a mother sat with her two adult daughters, drinking from blue and white paper cups, peering at the same phone. Oh, here's one. This guy's profile says he likes running, making his own kimchi, and dismantling capitalism. Curtis tried not to listen, but couldn't help himself. Darlie, he's twice my age. No, do you even understand how the app works? The name Darlie rang a bell, but Curtis couldn't quite place her. Brooklyn Heights was a small neighborhood. She was probably just someone he'd seen in line ordering sandwiches at Lassen, or someone he'd crossed paths with at the gym on Clark Street. Fine, fine. Okay, this guy says, cis male vegan seeks fellow steward of the earth. Never eat anything with a face, except the rich. You can't date a vegan. The footwear is ghastly, the mother interrupted. Give me that phone. The wifi here is terrible. Mom, it's pronounced Wi-Fi. Curtis risked a quick peek at the table. The three women were dressed in tennis whites, the mother a blonde with gold earrings and a notable array of rings on her fingers, the daughters both brunette, one lanky with straight hair cut to her shoulders, the other softer, with long wavy hair loosely tied in a knot. Curtis ducked his head back down and broke off a crumbly bite of poppy seed scone. Bi and non-monogamous looking for a commie mommy to help me smash the patriarchy. Hit me up to go dancing. Am I having a stroke? The older woman murmured. I don't understand a word of this. Curtis fought back a snicker. Mom, give me the phone. The wavy-haired daughter snatched back the iPhone and tossed it in her bag. With a start, Curtis realized he knew her. It was Georgiana Stockton. She had been in his high school class at Henry Street 10 years ago. He contemplated saying hello, but then it would be obvious he'd overheard their entire conversation. In my day, things were so much simpler, Georgiana's mother tutted. You just went out with your Deb Ball escort, or maybe your brother's roommate from Princeton. Right, Mom, but people my generation aren't giant elitist snobs, Georgiana said, and rolled her eyes. Curtis smiled to himself. He could imagine having the same exact conversation with his own mother, trying to explain why he wasn't going to marry her friend's daughter just because they owned adjoining properties on Martha's Vineyard. As Curtis watched Georgiana out of the corner of his eye, she suddenly jumped up from her chair. Oh no! I left my Cartier bracelet in Lena's BMW, and she's leaving soon for her grandmother's house in Southampton! Georgiana tossed her bag over her shoulder, grabbed her tennis racket off the floor, planted quick kisses on both her mother and sister, and clattered past Curtis to the door. As she swept by, her tennis racket banged Curtis's table, sloshing his coffee, dousing his poppy seed scone, and leaving him frowning in her wake. 1. Sasha. There was a room in Sasha's house that was a portal to another dimension, and that dimension was 1997. Here, Sasha discovered an egg-shaped iMac computer with a blue plastic shell, a ski jacket with a stack of hardened paper lift tags still affixed to the zipper, a wrinkled pile of airline boarding passes, and a one-hitter with an old yellow lighter hidden in the back of a drawer. Every time Sasha mentioned to her husband that she'd love to put her sister-in-law's high school ephemera in a box, he rolled his eyes and told her to be patient. She'll get her stuff when she has time. But Sasha had her doubts, and it was weird living in a home where one bedroom was entirely closed off, like a preserved shrine to a lost child. On good days, Sasha could acknowledge how incredibly lucky she was to live in her house. It was a 4-story Brooklyn limestone, a massive formal palace that could have held 10 of the 1-bedroom apartments Sasha had lived in before. But on bad days, Sasha felt she was living in a time capsule, the home her husband had grown up in and never left, filled with his memories, his childhood stories, but mostly his family's shit. When Sasha and Cord had been in the house for 3 weeks, Sasha invited her in-laws to dinner. "I'll make mushroom tarts and a goat cheese salad," she said in the email. She spent all morning rolling pie dough and even walked to the fancy market on Montague for pomegranate seeds to sprinkle over baby lettuces. She vacuumed the dining room, dusted the bookshelves, and put a Sancerre in the fridge. When her in-laws arrived, they had 3 L.L. Bean canvas bags in tow. "Oh, you didn't have to bring anything?" Sasha exclaimed, dismayed. "Sasha," her mother-in-law trilled, opening the closet to hang her Chanel boucle jacket. "We can't wait to hear all about your honeymoon." She carried the bags into the kitchen and proceeded to pull out a bottle of white burgundy, 2 flower arrangements in low vases, a tablecloth with fleur-de-lis on it, and 3 scalloped Williams-Sonoma baking dishes with lids. She lined them up on the counter and, like a woman at home in her kitchen of 40 years, opened up the cabinet to take down a glass for her wine. "I've made mushroom tarts," Sasha tried, suddenly feeling like the lady at the Costco free sample table trying to sell warm cubes of processed cheese. "Oh, I saw in your email, darling. I gathered that meant it was a French-themed dinner. You just let me know when you're 10 minutes away and I'll pop my coq au vin in the oven. I also have endive provençal, and I brought plenty, so we might not need your salad. The candlesticks are in the drawer there. Now let's go take a look at your tabletop arrangement, and I'll see what else we need." Out of solidarity, Cord ate the tart and the salad, but when Sasha caught him looking longingly at the endive, she gave him a thin smile that said, "You can eat the damned vegetables, but you might have to sleep on the couch." The agreement was new for all of them, and Sasha understood it was going to take some getting used to. Cord's parents, Chip and Tilda, had been complaining for years that their house was too big for the two of them, that it was too far from their garage, that they were tired of doing their own shoveling and hauling their own recycling out to the curb. They were investors in an apartment building 2 blocks away, the former Brooklyn Heights movie theater that was now 5 luxury condos, and they had decided to take the maisonette for themselves, moving in over the course of 1 week, using only their old Lexus and their housekeeper's husband, whom they paid $300. That seemed like a quick divestment from a house they'd inhabited for 4 decades, but aside from their clothing, Sasha couldn't really figure out what they had brought to the new place. They had even left their 4-poster king-size bed in their bedroom, and Sasha felt more than a little weird sleeping there. The Stocktons decided to let Sasha and Cord move into their vacant house and live there as long as they would like. Then, when they sold the place one day, they would split the money between Cord and his 2 sisters. There were some other pieces of the agreement designed to evade unnecessary inheritance taxes, but Sasha looked the other way for that bit of paperwork. The Stocktons may have let her marry their son, but she understood on a bone-deep level that they would rather let her walk in on them in the middle of an aerobic threesome with Tilda's bridge partner than have her studying their tax returns. After dinner, Sasha and Cord cleared the table while his parents headed into the parlor for an after-dinner drink. There was a bar cart in the corner of the room with old bottles of cognac that they liked to pour into tiny gold-rimmed glasses. The glasses, like everything else in the house, were ancient and came with a history. The parlor had long blue velvet drapes, a piano, and an itchy ball and clawfoot sofa that had once belonged in the governor's mansion. Sasha made the mistake of sitting on it once and got such a bad rash on the backs of her legs that she had to use calamine lotion before bed. There was a chandelier in the foyer, a grandfather clock in the dining room that chimed so loudly Sasha screamed a little the first time she heard it, and an enormous painting of a ship on a menacingly dark ocean in the study. The whole place had a vaguely nautical vibe, which was funny since they were in Brooklyn, not Gloucester or Nantucket. And though Chip and Tilda...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?